If you would, open up your Bibles to 2 Samuel. I got a new Bible, and 2 Samuel was after 1 Samuel, even in this one. So, in case you're having trouble finding it. But nonetheless, we're in the 9th chapter of 2 Samuel, and this is an account of a man named Mephibosheth. And I pray that I can say that correctly, probably 24 times or more. But right now, I got it anyway. You know, some may know the account very well, and some may not be familiar with it at all. So, don't worry. Lord willing, we'll cover it today. And as we get to the 9th chapter, we'll read verse 1, and I'll show you why we're going to need a little bit of background. 9th chapter, verse 1. And David said, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show kindness for Jonathan's sake?" So here we're given, it's mentioned Jonathan. You know, it's been several months since we read about Jonathan. Actually, the account of Jonathan's death was recorded in 1 Samuel. So I want to make sure we understand who Jonathan was and what David's referring to here. Jonathan was the son of Saul. Saul was the first king in Israel. He was the king that they went to Samuel and asked for. "Give us a king like the other nations." That was the one the Lord gave them. He was the ideal candidate for a king that met their eyes, met the qualifications through their eyes. He was taller than anyone in all of Israel. And he was handsome, according to the Bible. But he wasn't a good king. You know, he had a wicked heart, a depraved heart, and seemed to serve himself and care for his needs more than he did the needs of his people that he was there to serve, and more than he did for the Lord's needs, or the Lord's ways, I should say. You know, but Saul would have flashes, or he would show signs where it looked like, okay, he may be a pretty good king. And then he'd have about 3 steps backwards or more. And there's a verse I'll read here in just a minute that kind of sums up the life of Saul and kind of puts an exclamation point on the fact that we believe Saul was never saved. But I'm not here to debate that. But when the nation really needed a king, the nation really needed a leader, Saul was hiding. You know, and that's when Goliath, you know, when they're battling the Philistines, and Goliath comes out front and challenges the people of Israel and defies the living God. He did this for 40 days. And their leader, their king Saul, was basically terrified. Offered to give tax-free status to whoever would come and fight this giant. And then you have David, who just comes on a visit. He's too young to even be enrolled in the army. Goes there to visit his brothers, and he sees Goliath taunting the nation of Israel. So David takes up the challenge. It frustrates him that someone would mock his God like that. You know, not so much that he cared for a tax-free status as a kid. He just wanted to stand up for God, to defend the Lord's honor. And so he goes to Saul, the king. A kid goes to the king and says, basically, don't be worried anymore. I'll fight this giant. So they strap all this gear on him, and, you know, he couldn't wear the gear. It was too big for him. So he basically goes up there with a sling and a stone. And y'all know the story. David defeats Goliath. And that, you know, started to deliver them from the hand of the Philistines at that point. And at that point, David burst onto the scenes. He was well known throughout all of Israel. But there's a little bit of a problem with that, because the people started singing praises to David more than Saul. Saul hated him for that. You can be tax-free, but don't sing about it, right? So, and anyway, so when we get here in 1 Samuel chapter 20, the son of Saul was named Jonathan, and Jonathan loved David. His heart was knit together with David. They had a love for one another. And Jonathan says in 1 Samuel chapter 20, verse 14, "If I'm still alive, show me the steadfast love of the Lord. that I may not die. And do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever. When the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth, and Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord take vengeance on David's enemies. And Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. So this promise or this covenant we read about in 1 Samuel chapter 20, this is what David's fulfilling over here in 2 Samuel chapter 9. So just kind of keep that tucked away in the back of your mind. But see, you see, Jonathan seems to hint at the fact that David's going to be king. It was common knowledge that David was going to be the king. 1 Samuel 23, Jonathan says this, do not fear, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. And Saul my father knows this. Jonathan knew it. Saul knew it. Chapter 24, this is Saul speaking. Behold, speaking to David, behold, I know that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. So Saul knew David was going to be king, and Jonathan knew David was going to be king, and the people knew David was going to be king. We read about that in 2 Samuel chapter 5. They go to David and say, God is the one who told you, you shall be a prince over his people. Everyone knew David was going to be king. But yet we see Saul, again, trying to kill David almost at every turn. And he actually goes to Jonathan and he tells Jonathan, Saul tells his son Jonathan, as long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, and that's referring to David, as long as David is alive, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Therefore bring him to me, for he shall surely die. You know, Saul is blaming Jonathan for not wanting to kill David so his kingdom could be established. He never takes any responsibility for it's his sins. He's the reason the kingdom was torn from him and given to David. It wasn't Jonathan. But nonetheless, Jonathan answered Saul, his father, why shall he be put to death? You know, what has he done? What has he done? And Saul hurled his spear at him, his own son, to strike him. So then Jonathan knew that his father was determined to kill David. But the verse that, like I said, seems to put an exclamation point on the reign of Saul was in 1 Samuel 28. It says Saul had become an enemy of God. That's not good, folks. But Saul had fought against the will of God so often that he was referred to as an enemy of God. He knew the will of God, but yet he tried to kill David. You know, he just fought against the will of God so much. And we see in chapter 3 of 2 Samuel, verse 1, it says there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And David grew stronger and stronger while the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. So this, what you would think would be an easy transition of power because the Lord has torn the kingdom from my hand and given it to you, he bucked it. He bucked it at every turn. And even when Saul and all his sons were dead, they grabbed another son of Saul and put him on the throne and still fought against the will of God, all the while trying to hang on and maintain that power. And there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. So when David comes here and said, is there anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show kindness for Jonathan's sake? Look, he's wanting to find someone from the house of Saul who have been his enemies for years. All going back to this covenant he had made with Jonathan in chapter 20 of 1 Samuel. Now, Mephibosheth, we're fixing to read about, and I probably shouldn't jump ahead, but he's first going to be mentioned in chapter 4 of 2 Samuel. So I guess I'll just wait till I get there. Had that note probably in the wrong place. Okay, now there's two verses that kind of form the heart or the motivation of this chapter. And once you, if you wrap your mind around these, the rest of this kind of seems to fall in place. And one is in chapter 8, verse 15. It said, David reigned over all of Israel. He was king over all of Israel. And David administered justice and equity to all his people. The NIV translates that as he was doing what is just and right for all his people. For all the people, not just his political allies, not his buddies. David was doing what was just and right for all the people. And that included the house of Saul, his enemy. And then verse 3, where it says, that I may show the kindness of God to him. The kindness of God is a key phrase to understanding David's motivation in this chapter. David wanted to show someone else the same kind of kindness that God had showed him. So, I'll read verses 1 and we'll ease into verse 2. And David said, is there still anyone left among the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? Apparently they couldn't find anyone, and so they say there was a servant of the house of Saul named Ziba. And so they called him to David. And the king said to him, are you Ziba? And he says, yes, I am your servant. So here we're introduced to a servant of the house of Saul named Ziba. Now he's called a servant up here in verse 2. But if you look down in verse 9, it says the king called Ziba, again, Saul's servant. Most translations read it that way, but that's a different Hebrew word. That Hebrew word is, I'm not even going to try to pronounce it, but the NIV translates that as a steward. You know, then the king called Ziba, Saul's steward. So it seems, the NIV seems to try to capture that thought that he was more than just a servant. He was a keeper of the household, Ziba was. He was one who would manage the affairs of the house. And we learn in verse 10, if you look, I think it's the last sentence in verse 10, it says Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. So this servant had 20 servants, right? So we see there that he at least had some position of authority. I guess that was the point I was trying to make. He wasn't just a random servant. And he did know the whereabouts of anyone left of the house of Saul. That's why they sent for him. So they get him in verse 3. And the king said, is there not still someone of the house of Saul that I may show kindness, that I may show the kindness of God to him? And Ziba said to the king, there is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet. So Ziba knew the whereabouts of Mephibosheth, although he's not named here. We know who he is. And then he mentioned he's crippled in his feet. And he's crippled in his feet back in chapter 4. If you were to read chapter 4, verse 4, it says, Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled in his feet. And here's how it happened. When he was 5 years old, the news about Saul, his grandfather, and Jonathan, his father, came. And his nurse took him up and fled. And as she fled in her haste, he fell and became lame. And his name was Mephibosheth. So his injuries he sustained during this flight, this fear-filled flight, is what caused this permanent and lifelong disability that he had. So here Mephibosheth is, and he's crippled. Now, Ziba makes sure he points that out. But why would Ziba mention the fact that he's crippled in his feet? Just out of the blue. I mean, I wonder this, you know, is there anyone left of the house of Saul? For I'd like to show him kindness for the sake of Jonathan. Yeah, Jonathan has a son. He's crippled. You know, why would he mention that? Did he think that maybe mentioning his handicap would cause David to pause? You know, to maybe, maybe pull back a little bit in his effort to honor the commitment he made to Jonathan? You know, as if David would say, you know, I wouldn't mind helping a little, but this is full-time responsibility. Is that why? I don't know. I mean, my mind just races and makes you, you've had people before maybe tell you, you know, if something happens to me and my wife, would you take care of our kids? And then something happens and one of the kids ends up having a special need or a handicap and it ends up being way more than you signed up for. More than you bargained for. You can't squirm away from that commitment. You can't. David can't pull back. He can't squirm away from what he promised Jonathan. Regardless of his needs, regardless of the circumstances, David is committed. So what would the king want with a cripple? I'm sure this is what's going through Ziba's mind. What would the king want with a cripple? Well, here's what. He's going to show him the kindness of God. He tells you right off the bat what he wants. Is there anyone left that I can show him the kindness of God? That's what David wants with him. David is basically looking at Ziba and saying, look, I'm not like Saul. I'm not like the world. The world may tell me that this isn't a good political move, and trust me, they would have. They would have told him, there's no need to try to welcome the enemy into your house, David, especially one who's lame. He wouldn't even make a good servant. Politically, there's no benefit to this. There's no benefit to this, David. But David, like I said, wasn't like the world. David was what we could call a follower of Christ. And followers of Christ show love. They show compassion. They show mercy. And a follower of Christ should honor a commitment at all costs. So I thought about this question. Do we ever show the kindness of God to the undeserving? Do we? If not, shame on us. You know, Matthew 5:14, this is a familiar passage. Matthew 5 says, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. When you show kindness, compassion, mercy, love toward others, it gives glory to God. So should we be trying to show the kindness of God to others? Absolutely. You know, if you read the parable of the unforgiven servant in Matthew 18, it's about a king who wished to settle his accounts, and a man comes to him and owes an unimaginable amount of money, never could pay it back, and the king forgives that debt. The man goes to someone who owes him a fraction of what he owes the king. The guy couldn't pay it back. He grabs him by the throat and throws him in prison. In verse 33, says this, should you not have had mercy on your fellow servant as I have had mercy on you? Basically, the thought is, the king has forgiven you, should you not forgive them? Christ has shown us a great love. Should we not love others? That's the teaching here. But Ziba informs David, yes, there's still a son of Jonathan. However, he is lame. However, he is a crippled. And then you get David right off the bat in verse 4, seems to say, where is he? You know, in my opinion, he's basically saying, Ziba, I don't care if he's crippled. Where is he? So Ziba tells him in verse 4, the king said, where is he? His disability doesn't matter. Where is he at? Where is he? The king said, let me find my place again. Okay, and Ziba said to the king, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel at Lodabar. Then the king David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel at Lodabar. So David here inquires where he's at, and Ziba knows not only where the town he's at, but the exact house he's at. So Lodabar, from what most people think, Lodabar was east of the Jordan. That may not mean much to you, but if you read Numbers 34, the land east of the Jordan was not part of the Promised Land. So Mephibosheth, a grandson of the king, was living outside the land of promise. And he had been there in hiding. And the king sends for him. And you can imagine, you know, he was 5 years old, I believe it said in chapter 4, when he fell. And he fell right when his father and grandfather died. Okay? Then David, that's when Ish-bosheth reigned and David both reigned. They did that for 7 years. So that would put basically Mephibosheth at 12 when David assumed the reign over all of Israel. Okay? And it took some time. Nobody really knows exactly how much time, but it took some time for David to kind of capture Jerusalem, go get the ark, and put all these other enemies at bay. So most people think Mephibosheth here is probably around 20 years old. He's not a young kid. He's a young man. And he actually is mentioned of having a son here in verse 12. If you'll look, Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah. Now, my opinion is he had Micah when in Lodabar. You know, some people think he didn't have him until he was living with David in Jerusalem, and I guess I wouldn't argue if you did think that, but he was of age to where he could, it wouldn't be out of the norm for him to have a son. So this young man had been hiding for what seems like about 15 years. He's been hiding from everybody, from the world. Crippled, outside the land of promise, just living in this guy's house, just trying to live out his life. And then you see the king's army coming. Or not the king's army, but the king's men coming. And you know it just had to, his stomach and his heart had to drop. And then you hear the boom, 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 knocking on the door, you know, and then Mephibosheth, the king sent us to get you. And you know that just had, I said, to just make his heart drop. Because we see in verse 7, real quick, and I'll read 5 through 7 here, but in verse 7 it says, do not fear. David says to Mephibosheth, do not fear. And so that right there implies that, or indicates that Mephibosheth was afraid, and he should have been afraid. You know, it was very common for a new king to wipe out any opposition to the throne. That's what they did. I'll tell you what, turn to 1 Kings chapter 15. That's just the next book over. Should be easy to find. I'll give you a couple of examples that are close by, but there's many. 1 Kings chapter 15, look at verse 29. This is about a king named Baasha, B-A-A-S-H-A. All right, it says in verse 29, and as soon as he was king, he killed all the house of Jeroboam. He left to the house of Jeroboam not one that breathed until he had destroyed it. Killed everybody. He tried to eliminate any threat to the throne. Look in verse 16. I'm sorry, chapter 16, verse 11 of 1 Kings. And when he began to reign, this is Zimri, and when he began to reign, as soon as he had seated himself on the throne, he struck down all the house of Baasha. He did not leave a single male of his relatives or his friends. Now, there's more stories like this we could read if we just took the time. But it just didn't happen in the history of Israel. It happened in Babylon, Persia. It was just natural. You even see it to a degree in American politics today. The first thing they do when they win the election and or have powers, they purge. They purge pretty much any of the opposing party out. They don't kill them like they did in this day, but they get them out. You know, so we it's natural for Mephibosheth to think, the gig's up. He's got me. I'm the last remaining descendant of Jonathan, or the last remaining descendant of Saul, and he's gonna come get me. But that's not what happened. Let's read verses 5 through 7. Then the king David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lodabar. And Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, fell on his face, and paid homage. You know, just was humble, paid him honor. And David said, Mephibosheth. And he answered, behold, I am your servant. And David said to him, do not fear. For I will show you the kindness for the sake of your father, Jonathan. All right, so now he's starting to be able to breathe a little bit, right? I'm going to show you kindness because of your father, Jonathan. I'm going to restore to you all the land of Saul, your father. Now he's starting to look up a little bit like, wait, this is, all right, you're going to spare me. Now you're actually going to restore all the land of my father, Saul, and you shall eat at my table always. Wow, I mean, I just know this was a complete reversal of what he had thought. He went in there more than likely thinking he was going to have his head chopped off, and he ends up being able to eat at the king's table, have all his land restored, and he was protected by the king. Not to fear. Amazing. This was amazing, especially in this time. This was an enemy. You know, they had been fighting this house for years. And his grandfather tried to kill him over and over and over and over. But he says here, I'm going to restore to you the land of your father Saul. Okay, there's three options there. Option one, David meant he was going to take it from Ziba and give it back to Mephibosheth. Because Ziba had pretty much not acquired the land. He didn't own it, but he was kind of managing it, and there was no one there who had any more power over that land than Ziba, the steward of the land. You know, Mephibosheth, the, I guess, rightful heir to the land, was gone in the hiding. So maybe he meant he was going to take it back from Ziba. I don't necessarily think that's what he's talking about. Maybe it meant that David had acquired the land through conquest. You know, he had conquered the house of Saul, and he just acquired the land. But I don't think that's it either. If we look back a couple of chapters, when David conquered Jerusalem, he allowed some of the Jebusites, you know, he put the Jebusites at bay who were living and reigning in Jerusalem. All right, well, he still allowed some of the Jebusites to own land right there around and in Jerusalem. Because he goes to a man named Araunah, the Jebusite, and has to buy the land from him to put the temple on. So not only did he just let them live there, they actually owned the land that David had conquered, so to speak, right? So here's another possibility. David had acquired it through marriage. You know, if you look at Numbers 27, it says this: if a man dies and has no son, then you shall transfer his inheritance to his daughter. Was this why David wanted Michal back? You know, David had married the daughter of Saul, Michal. And when David was running from his father-in-law, the king, he took her and gave her to somebody else. And then when David comes back and he's all of a sudden king again, he says, hey, I want her back. Was that why he wanted her back? I don't know. But like I said, Numbers says all the land passes to the daughter. But anyway, David here is going to restore this land back to Mephibosheth. We see that much anyway. But I want to take notice real quick of the change in language we have here. Look, if you look up, and I'm trying to move through this pretty fast, in verse 2, when David is interacting with Ziba, it always refers to him as the king. We see verse 2, and the king said to him, are you Ziba? Verse 3, and the king said, Ziba said to the king. And then you go on to verse 4, the king said. You see, you kind of get the king and servant relationship established pretty good there when he's dealing with David. But when David deals with Mephibosheth, how do you see it? You see it, what's that, verse 6. They came to David, and David said, Mephibosheth. Verse 7, and David said to him. I'm not saying it means anything. I thought it may be worth pointing out, though, that when David is dealing with Ziba, he's always referred to as the king. When he's dealing with Mephibosheth, it's more of a David and Mephibosheth, more of a personal relationship that he has with Mephibosheth. Well, after David had promised all these things to Mephibosheth, in verse 8, it said Mephibosheth paid honor and said, what is your servant that you should show regard for such a dead dog as I? Now, some insist on this being a dead dog is meaning that I'm some kind of despised person. That's what Mephibosheth was saying, you know, I'm crippled, I'm some kind of despised person. But really, David called himself a dead dog when Saul was seeking his life. He says, why have you come out to me as a dead dog? I'm nothing but a flea, he actually says in 1 Samuel 24. So it's probably meant more to exaggerate the difference in rank, their difference in social standing. You know, you're a king, and I'm as valuable as a dead dog. That's what he's trying to say. And actually, Mephibosheth will say later on that my family was men who were doomed to death until you came, David. So verse 9. Then the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, all that belonged to Saul and to his house I've given to your master's grandson, being Mephibosheth. So David declares publicly what he had said privately to Mephibosheth. So I'll read on. And you, Ziba, and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him and shall bring in the produce that your master's grandson may have bread to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall always eat at my table. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Then Ziba said to the king, according to all that the Lord, the king, commands his servants, so will your servants do. So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. Now, I don't want you to get the idea here that Ziba is somewhat of a good, humble guy. He's not. Ziba's pretty upset with the way this whole thing shook out. And Ziba, the way we would look at it, has come from rags to riches, only to have the king now cast him back down and force him to work for a cripple. Ziba's not happy with this at all. If we look in chapter 16 of 2 Samuel, we'll kind of cover just a few things. I was hesitant to cover it, but I thought it'd be several months before we got there, and y'all would forget it. So it'd be like covering it for the first time, right? But David's son, Absalom, you know, starts to rise up against his father, David. And David actually flees Jerusalem, leaves Jerusalem because of this. And we see in chapter 16, verse 1, David had passed a little beyond the summit. Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him. Met him with a couple of donkeys saddled, bearing 200 loaves of bread, 100 bunches of raisins, 100 of summer fruits, and a skin of wine. The king David said to Ziba, why have you brought these? Ziba answered, these donkeys are for the king's household to rise on, and the bread and the summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine for those who faint in the wilderness to drink. Then David said, Where's your master's son? Talking about Mephibosheth. Ziba said to the king, behold, he remains in Jerusalem. For he said, today the house of Israel will be given back to the kingdom of my father. Verse 4. Then the king said to Ziba, all that belonged to Mephibosheth is now yours. And Ziba said, I pay homage. Let me ever find favor in your sight, my lord the king. So when you see this, you see David leaving, you see Ziba the servant giving him all these provisions, and he says, hey, where's Mephibosheth? Oh, he stayed back in Jerusalem. He said, now the house, the kingdom is coming back to the line of Saul. So this just had to hurt David. This had to just pour salt on a wound. I was good to this cripple, and he did me this way. Everything everybody told me about don't let him in, don't let him near, maybe that was true. But then when we get to chapter 19. Now at chapter 19, Absalom has died. And David is coming back to Jerusalem. And as David comes back to Jerusalem, it says in chapter 19, verse 24, he met Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king, David. He had neither taken care of his feet, nor trimmed his beard, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came back in safety. And when he came to Jerusalem to meet the king, David, said to him, why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? He answered, my lord, O king, my servant deceived me. For your servant said to him, I will saddle a donkey for myself that I may ride on it and go with the king. For your servant is lame. He has slandered your servant to my lord the king, but the Lord my king is like one of the angels of God. Do therefore what seems good to you. For all my father's house were but men doomed to death before my lord the king. But you set your servant among those who eat at your table. What further right have I then than to cry to the king? So basically he's saying, look, he took advantage of me. I'm lame. I couldn't have done it. I was going to saddle a donkey and I was going to go with you, but Ziba basically just took advantage of a situation. Ziba left me there, knowing I couldn't do anything about it, took all this stuff and went and presented the case as if I didn't want to go. I was actually going to stay behind and you know, be ascended to the throne. But you see, he's doing that after he hadn't shaved. You can't fake that. You know, it's one thing to say, you know, I hadn't ate since you've been gone. But, I mean, he hadn't shaved. He hadn't taken care of nothing. David has to know Mephibosheth is telling the truth and Ziba was lying. Ziba was using this situation to his advantage. Because Ziba, back in chapter 9, is not happy that now Mephibosheth is his master again. But he goes on in 19, verse 29. The king said, "Why speak any more of your affairs? Oh, I have decided, you and Ziba shall divide the land." And Mephibosheth said to the king, "Oh, let him take it all, since my lord the king has come home safely." I thought about that. Shouldn't that be our response? You know, as long as my lord the king is on the throne, let him have it all. That's what Mephibosheth said. Hey, you ain't got to split it. Give it all to him. I'm glad my lord the king is on the throne. We should have that response, right? As long as God reigns, let them have everything. It doesn't matter. But let's get back. Chapter 9, verse 13. No, 12. Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah, and all who lived in Ziba's house became Mephibosheth's servants. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate always at the king's table. Now, he was lame in both his feet. So David went far beyond just sparing Mephibosheth. That's really all Jonathan was asking in 1 Samuel chapter 20, is just that I shall not die. Just don't kill us. But David went far beyond sparing his life. He adopted him and really provided for him always. You see that in verse 7, verse 10, and verse 13. He shall always eat at my table. He shall always eat at my table. And when I say he was adopted, I guess I get that referring to verse 11 where it says, like one of the king's sons. So there wasn't a difference. It's not like he was a charity case. You know, there wasn't really a difference in the treatment of Mephibosheth and the treatment of one of the own king's sons, or the king's own sons. David provided for him always. But as we went through that story, I hope you have a better understanding of this event. But I wanted to notice some similarities in closing. Now, most of us don't want to think of ourselves as being similar to Mephibosheth. We like to think somehow the king should be grateful to have someone like us in his kingdom. But that's just simply not true. We are exactly like Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth, here's a couple of similarities. Mephibosheth was of his father Saul, meaning it was his bloodline that made him an enemy to the king. Right? We're of our father Adam. Our bloodline, our nature, naturally makes us an enemy to the king. We are outcast. You know, he was living in Lodabar outside the land of promise. We were living outside the land of promise, outside the will of God. We were attempting to run and hide from the king, much like Mephibosheth. You know, chapter 9 opens and closes with the comment of Mephibosheth being crippled in his feet, being lame in both his feet. It opens and closes with that comment, in a sense, trying to drive it home. You know, his own ability couldn't get him into the kingdom. And his own ability could not keep him in the kingdom. You know, much like us. He was crippled. He was unable to come to the king, much like us. Because of his handicap, he wouldn't even make a good servant. When you were brought into the kingdom, when you were brought before the king, you didn't have anything to offer. Like Mephibosheth, we are all unable to come to the king, unworthy to come to the king, unwilling to come to the king. But you see, the king seeks after us. David sought after Mephibosheth. David sent for Mephibosheth. The king seeks after us. The king sends for us. The king calls us by name. The king restores us. And the king provides for us always. You know, in Matthew 8, you know, the Lord is telling, I think it's the Pharisees, something that they just grind their teeth at. They can't stand it. But he's saying, hey, look, many will come from east and west and recline at the table. You know, we will all eat at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. Much like this outsider eating at the king's table. In closing, turn to Romans 5 if you hadn't put your Bible up. Romans 5, 6 through 10. Just in case you may think, I've never been weak. You know, I never was an enemy of God, so to speak. All right. Romans chapter 5, verse 6 says this. For while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. God died for the ungodly. That's interesting, isn't it? But it said he did so when we were weak. Verse 8. But God shows his love for us that while we were still sinners, he died for us. Verse 10. For while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his Son. So look, he died for us while we were enemies, while we were sinners, and while we were weak. You know, we're no different when you look at it like that. So God here, this is a perfect picture of the kindness of God. The love of God is what Jesus Christ has done for us. So we need to thank God that he sought after us when we were not seeking him. Truth is, we were hiding. But God sought us while we were still sinners. He died for us while we were enemies, and he brought us into the kingdom, adopted us as children, and restored us. So don't think too highly of yourself. You're simply a Mephibosheth, whom the king, by his own will, desired to extend his grace, his love, and his mercy. So praise God that we have a lens or just a picture through the life of David and Mephibosheth that we can see how God treats us. Would please stand. Brother Bill, would you close us out?